When I last recorded a broadcast, it was June 2020, and we'd come up to the point where Dylan was about to release Rough and Rowdy Ways, his 39th studio album, and the world was in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. So back then, I finished my project, my projected project, which was to cover Dylan's life up to the present moment, and that felt good. It felt like the right time to stop or take a break. In the meantime, I've gotten some fantastic correspondence from people who have listened to the podcast, who kindly were encouraging me to continue to add episodes, pointing out how infinite, really, the supply of topics related to Dylan is, and that's true, but I don't feel that I'm necessarily the person to talk about those things in the best way, or that what I would say about those topics is really necessary for anyone to hear. While I was open to the idea of doing one or more additional podcasts in the future, I wanted to wait until the right thing landed. I was thinking that I wanted to explore my own journey with Dylan, my own journey through Dylan's work, my personal experiences with the music and live shows, and the journey of how I've come to the present moment with Dylan. I thought that could be somewhat interesting as a podcast, as long as I kept the focus on different aspects of Dylan's work, moments in his chronology, and somehow through that unearth the perspective that I had on Dylan's work at various points along the way. Basically, I wanted to explore my experience of listening to Dylan through the years. This is episode 16 of a Bob Dylan primer, Nothing But Affection. The idea for this episode 16 came to me in the early spring of 2021, and I thought it would be a fine thing to have the episode ready for broadcast on Dylan's 80th birthday, which came and went on May 24th, 2021. But for various reasons, I didn't finish the work in time for Dylan's big day, and that bummed me out for a minute until I saw the virtual avalanche of tributes and articles and memes and performances all wishing Dylan a happy birthday, and also a tall stack of new or revised books about Dylan. Maybe it was all too much. And so then I got a little queasy about piling on more unnecessary Dylan stuff. And as I'm writing these words, I'm having second thoughts and still not finished with this episode. But I'd like to power through because I feel like I can learn something through the process. And I would also like to try and clarify my thoughts about all this Dylan stuff, which of course includes this podcast. Jumping right in, I don't have a clear first memory of hearing Dylan. I do have a memory of being over at my neighbor's house in what must have been the summer of 1965. This family lived across the street from mine, and they were a big Irish Catholic family with five kids and lots of relatives and friends. And when I was very young, this family was kind of the main conduit through which I received American pop culture. My family was small and somewhat insular, and my parents were Viennese and looked down on pop culture for the most part. So it was across the street at this big family's house that I first heard the Beatles, first heard the Beach Boys, first ate barbecued steaks and watermelon, first learned about hot rod culture, motorcycles, firecrackers, and other small explosives. And they had a record player in their den, and starting in about 1965, the older kids in the family would spend the money they earned doing chores on 45s, on singles, vinyl. I have an image of standing in their den in the late summer of 65, facing the record player as we played through the stack. I can clearly remember hearing I Got You, Babe by Sonny and Cher, Eve of Destruction by Barry McGuire, California Girls by the Beach Boys, Fun, Fun, Fun by the Beach Boys, Help by the Beatles, and my personal favorite, I'm Henry VIII, I Am by Herman's Hermits. But I also remember hearing Like a Rolling Stone come out of that record player, and it sounded like nothing else. So, after getting this sort of hit of pop music, I wasn't exposed to all that much over the next few years. Rock and roll was not banned from my household, but it wasn't looked upon too favorably. So basically, I was getting music from The Ed Sullivan Show on Sunday nights, and what I picked up in the car with friends or hearing on the radio while I was out in the street. I had a few singles of my own, but no albums yet. My best friend and I somehow fell in love with Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, and he had a copy of their album Whipped Cream, which at that time seemed to represent the sum total of everything that music could be to my 10-year-old being. But then I got to junior high school, and everything kind of broke open there. It was just before the rise of FM radio, and so you had the situation where AM radio was kind of busting at the seams. We had a very cool school bus driver. I'm going to name check him here. Dear Mr. Van Egden, who would play the two powerhouse local stations, which were KHJ and KRLA, on the drive to and from school through the bus speakers, which felt so transgressive and amazing. And pretty much from that moment on, the kind of passion I had for pop music, which had been somewhat latent, pretty much exploded. I fell asleep every night with a transistor radio playing low under my pillow, and I lived for the biweekly Friday night dances at my junior high, where we had a jukebox that we'd roll out onto the gym floor, and they'd connect the jukebox to some crummy PA speakers, and that was our sound system. And the position of jukebox button pusher was very vaunted and mysterious, and I'm still not sure how the people who held that role were picked. But it was basically like being the Wizard of Oz as far as having the power to shape the hearts and souls of all these sweaty teenagers. And that jukebox had songs that today would be the envy of any ultra-curated hipster cocktail bar playlist. Respect by Aretha, White Room, Wichita Lineman, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, Hey Jude, Piece of My Heart, Janice's version, Poor Side of Town, Dance to the Music by Sly and the Family Stone, Heard It Through the Grapevine, both Marvin Gaye's and Creedence version, Ball of Confusion by The Temptations. I could go on and on. I'm pretty sure I could come close to remembering every record on that jukebox given a little time. There was no Dylan on the jukebox, but you'd hear him sometimes on the radio, and it seemed like the radio DJs still liked to play Positively 4th Street quite a bit. In 1969, Lay Lady Lay was a big radio hit, but it was almost like that was an anomaly. It seemed like people weren't really connecting Lay Lady Lay to the sort of Bob Dylan of popular consciousness, which was the protest folk poet, even though he'd long since left that mantle behind. Another thing that was happening at that time was that protests against the Vietnam War were really heating up and drawing huge numbers, unlike anything the country had really ever seen before. That protest had a strong draw for me, so along with a few friends, I would go to meetings and rallies and anti-war marches, and often at these gatherings, songs were sung. And the two songs that I remember most strongly as being sung were Where Have All the Flowers Gone, which just slayed me back then, and Blowin' in the Wind, which also had this powerful, almost hypnotizing effect. And for me, even at a young age, there was something about the sound of Blowing in the Wind and its simplicity, and even in the derivative nature of the melody, there was something about the sound, and I'll give credit to Dylan's voice, that communicated something bigger, much bigger than a protest song. And so this was all kind of percolating around, and I think it was the summer before I started high school, let's say the summer of 1971. And one night, I went to a small gathering. It wasn't really a party. We were just hanging out at a friend of mine's house. And there was a small group of people there. She had an older brother, and so there were some older people in the house, too. There were probably 10 people hanging out. And I went into the living room, and there was no one else in there. Everybody else was in the kitchen or out in the yard. And there was a stereo in the living room, and some record was playing. I don't remember what it was. But leaning against the stereo cabinet was Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits, Volume 1, with that eyeball-searing cover photo of Dylan's head silhouetted in that glowing blue halo. And so whatever was playing finished, and I picked up the Dylan record and I put it on the turntable. And this, even today, thinking about it, it felt like the beginning of something for me. Maybe the first scratching of adulthood, There was something about making my own choice about what record to put on, and no one else was around. And so the record started, and I remember I sat back in this big high-backed armchair holding onto the album cover, and I was trying to be so cool listening to this record and not paying attention to the others in the house. And as Blowin' in the Wind was playing, something happened. And I knew that this was the guy that I wanted to listen to and learn more about. That was basically the spark. So this seed was planted in my mind. And I think I must have started to talk about Dylan to my friends, because in the summer of 1972, my junior high girlfriend gave me a copy of the new definitive, really the only biography of Bob Dylan called Bob Dylan. And this copy that my girlfriend gave me was signed by the author, and he wrote, "Peace, Tony Scaduto," on the end papers, which was pretty cool. I just devoured that book like one does when you haven't read that many books. And you just consume each word and sentence gets into your mind and even into your body. And I don't know how many times I read that book that summer, but I read it over and over again, and it fanned the small flame of feeling I had about Dylan. And at that point, I figured I knew everything there was to know about Bob Dylan's life. And now that I'd read that book, I'd better start focusing on the music. So that summer, I bought The Greatest Hits Volume 2. So now I really had Dylan covered, and that was a double vinyl album, so I would sit in the living room of my family's house and play the record, mostly in the afternoons when no one else was around. And that double vinyl album was a commitment because there were four sides, and rarely were you going to have time to play all four sides, not to speak of the physical energy to get up four times to flip the record and then sit back down again. So usually when I'd pull the record out to play it, I had to make a choice of what side I was going to listen to, and it seems, looking back now, that I focused pretty heavily on sides 1 and 4. I loved the live Tomorrow Is a Long Time. I loved the I Shall Be Released and You Ain't Going Nowhere, with wonderful Happy and Artie Traum backing Dylan up. That double album pushed me into becoming a verified, albeit small or short, Dylan freak. The next Dylan thing that happened was that Sam Peckinpah directed Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. And not only did Dylan have a small but memorable part in the movie, but he also did the soundtrack. And I remember just after the movie came out, I cajoled these two friends of mine to go see it. And we went to the old Pacific Theater on Hollywood Boulevard. And I remember we sat in the balcony and there were about 10 people or less in the entire theater. And my friends gave me a lot of shit for what they considered a bad movie and a silly performance by Dylan. But I bought the soundtrack and listened to it a lot. And of course, Knockin' on Heaven's Door was a minor FM radio hit. I just want to say, I think Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid it's my favorite Peckinpah film. And I do think it's a small masterpiece. Anyway, about Dylan, it seemed, and I know I've touched on this before, it seemed like Dylan's career at that point was pretty much finished. He was playing a small part in a movie that didn't do well. He wasn't writing or recording much, and no one really cared that much about him at the moment, or at least not the way people had cared earlier. Of course, the Dylan freaks were still listening to his music, and for me it was kind of great because I got the chance to slowly catch up with Dylan's prior output without being distracted by new material. Moving now to the fall of 1973, and I become totally focused on music, listening to my handful of record albums and FM radio pretty much nonstop. And this time period was marked by me having my driver's license and the combination of driving around early 1970s Los Angeles and FM radio created an alchemical reaction that completely transformed my personality, my thinking, pretty much everything. My source of news about music came from three places. There was the FM radio, which in Los Angeles at that time, for me, was mostly KMET and KLOS. There was Rolling Stone magazine, which was the biweekly Bible. And then there was the coverage in the LA Times by the local rock critic Robert Hilburn. Hilburn had a big feature column on Sunday, and then there was usually a smaller column on Thursdays, and then on Saturdays, in the local section of the paper, Hilburn ran a column that was mostly just upcoming news about shows or new releases. And on Saturday, November 3rd, 1973, I grabbed the paper, and I always look for Hilburn's column first, so I flipped to the third page of that section, and I read the opening line of his column that morning, which said, "Ready for a bombshell? Bob Dylan and the band are going on tour." And I threw the newspaper down and started running around my family's house screaming. I would say I was in some kind of shock. It seemed impossible to imagine that I was going to get a chance to see Dylan in person. And when the shock of that possibility started to sink in, the next thing was, how on earth am I going to get tickets for this show? And I could probably fill an entire podcast episode with how I tried to get tickets for the Dylan shows in LA. But let's just cut to that week in February, when Dylan finally arrived in town to play three concerts at the Los Angeles Forum, one on February 13th and two shows on Valentine's Day, February 14th, one in the afternoon and one that night. I had miraculously managed to get tickets for both of the evening shows. When the show arrived in town, we had no idea what the music was going to sound like. It's not like today, where if you're a fan and you go to a show, thanks to the internet almost always, you know what mode that performer is in at that particular time, and you can even listen to concerts before they show up and so forth. But I was 16 years old, and I was trying to process my scant knowledge of music, and I had no idea of what to expect, really. One thing I did to prepare for the concerts was that since the tour opened in Chicago on January 3rd, 1974, I figured out that I could go down to one of several wonderful newsstands we had in Hollywood at that time and look for a review of the Chicago show, because the newsstands had a huge collection of international newspapers, but also what they called hometown papers, daily papers from most of the big cities in the U.S. And it would take a couple of days for them to arrive, so on January 5th or 6th, I went down and picked up the Chicago Tribune from January 4th, which I guessed correctly would have a review of the Dylan show. And then I did this for pretty much every tour stop along the way until the shows arrived in Los Angeles. February 13th, 1974 was a Wednesday, and for a week before that I could barely sleep. I skipped gym class that entire week because I was afraid I might break my leg or get some other injury before the shows, and basically I was filled to the brim with anticipation. So that Wednesday I got into my family's 1970 Buick Wildcat and picked up two friends, and we drove to the Inglewood Forum. Our seats were on the floor about 30 rows back for that first show. The lights went down and a huge roar went up, and you could barely make out some figures on stage moving around. And then the electric chords of Robbie Robertson banging out the opening to "Most Likely You'll Go Your Way." And then the spotlight hit Dylan at center stage, scowling behind his aviator sunglasses. It felt like a train was passing through my body. I pretty much completely lost it. I remember me and my two friends got up on the chairs and stood on the chairs, which a bunch of other people did as well. But anyway, of course, my favorite parts of the shows were the acoustic solo sets in the middle, but the entire concert was nonstop, awe-striking. I think that the 74 tour has been unjustly maligned by a lot of hardcore Dylan fans who may have been swayed by comments Dylan made about the tour, hinting that it was too much of a business venture. I think those comments were made in the context of explaining how and why the Rolling Thunder tours came into being as a kind of reaction to what was happening in pop music. And one day, hopefully, the bootleg series will issue a definitive collection from the 1974 tour that goes deeper than the Before the Flood double album. Make no mistake, the Bob Dylan that showed up on stage in early 1974 was there to stake his claim as the most potent force in pop music and to let everyone know that he meant business, and that he'd be sticking around for a while. So, When the 1974 tour hit, it felt like a miracle. And from that point forward, there have been a number of other miracle moments where you found yourself feeling that Dylan was in a rut or played out or had nothing more to say or couldn't move you the way other artists could. But then he would put out what I'm calling his miracles. Blood on the Track certainly qualifies, as does Infidels, both Oh Mercy and Time Out of Mind. And definitely Dylan saved one of his greatest miracles for his most recent record, Rough and Rowdy Ways. And the big lesson that Dylan is teaching us here is the danger of expectations, both expectations of the creative process and also of the process of absorbing creative work, so that expectation always, by its very nature, gets in the way of an untrammeled approach to new work. Dylan is the professor emeritus of that particular college in terms of defying expectations and kind of teaching you not to have them. That year of 1974, especially the first half, was rich with Dylan treasures. The tour, which pretty much overwhelmed everything, and Planet Waves, which came out that January, and then the Before the Flood double LP, just as I graduated from high school. I probably had half a dozen Dylan albums by this point, and I know I had the pink book of lyrics called Writings and Drawings, which I studied assiduously. And I remember that the week of my high school graduation, I borrowed the yearbook of my biggest high school crush, and I wrote out all the lyrics to Ramona, which to me seemed like a fitting poem for her at that moment. So I copied the lyrics into her yearbook, and I remember I took up the entire page, and then I gave the yearbook back to her, and I'm sure it made absolutely no sense to her why I felt compelled to write all of that to her, but I did, and that was that. It didn't change her mind towards me in any way, so I guess Dylan's magic has its limits, or at least did back then. I want to take a little detour here to talk about bootlegs. I guess from reading Scaduto's book and articles about Dylan, I was aware of the bootleg album called Great White Wonder, which allegedly was the very first rock bootleg album, and it appeared originally in 1969 and quickly achieved a kind of mythic status. And hearing about it for me was like hearing about the Holy Grail. It seemed like something I'd never actually get the chance to hear because it was so rare, and that moment where it was circulating had passed, and it was illegal, and it really seemed far off. And when I was still in high school, I went to the UCLA library to do some research on something, and I loved poking through the old card catalogs, and I was doing that, and sure enough, it wasn't long before I searched through the D's to see if there was anything on Bob Dylan, and there might have been a book or two. But then I noticed an entry from the Special Collections audio department listing Great White Wonder as a 2-album vinyl record. So I thought, well, this can't be possible. But I wrote down the call letters and I brought it to the librarian. And after waiting a few minutes, I was directed to a small room with a turntable. No speakers, just these incredibly funky headphones that were made out of like Bakelite. And they looked like World War II era issue. And there in front of me was an off-white record album jacket with 2 records inside. So I put the first album on, trembling, of course, and then placed the headphones over my ears and began to listen. You couldn't check the album out and take it home, but I sat there and listened to the whole thing. And I can remember how fast my heart was beating as I heard the first notes play. The quality of the record was, especially through that sound system, was pretty awful. And I couldn't really figure out what I was listening to for the most part, but it was still amazingly cool. And after that time period, bootlegs started appearing in record stores almost on an open basis. They were still completely illegal, and criminal penalties were high, but it seemed like enforcement was lax. So some of the cooler record stores used to just stick bootlegs in the bins, and you began seeing them more and more. And when I got to Berkeley in 1975, the bootleg scene was wide open. There were several record stores that carried dozens and dozens of bootlegs, and Dylan boots probably made up the largest chunk. So I bought the 1964 Halloween concert that way, the so-called Royal Albert Hall bootleg, which was actually from Manchester, and a bunch of other stuff. I started college, went to Berkeley, and Berkeley at that time must have had one of the greatest concentrations of record shops per capita of any town in the country. There were maybe five or six terrific places within about a 15-minute walk that sold albums, and I was surrounded by people my age who all seemed to be as obsessed with music as I was, and there was also a lighthouse FM radio station at that moment, the great, great KSAN. And the combination of all these things made it possible to basically just mainline music into your system 24 hours a day, or however many hours in the day that you weren't sleeping or in class. There were a lot of new sounds available to my ears. And then, all of a sudden, in January of 1975, word was bubbling up that a new Dylan album was on the way, and then KSAN started playing Tangled Up in Blue. And the thing back then was, there were always a few weeks where radio stations had the album before it was released to the public, so you'd be listening all day to the radio hoping they'd play this new stuff. And that was also the time when cassette players were starting to take hold. So as soon as you heard the tune come on the air, you'd run to your stereo system and hit record. And it was just on your mind at all times of the day and night. And we got pretty good at this, so many times you just lose maybe 10 seconds at the top of the tune and you could record the rest, because you would cue the tape up first and you'd have a special cassette that was just for recording songs off the radio, and you'd lock it into record and hit pause, turn the radio on, so all you had to do was unlock the pause button and it would start recording. So I got to learn a few of the new songs, Tangled Up in Blue and I think Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts too. And then on January 20th, 1975, the record came out, Blood on the Tracks. And every morning I'd get up and go across the hall to my friend's room, who had a turntable and a 12-cup Norelco coffee maker. And we'd start a pot of coffee and put Blood on the Tracks on and listen to it while passing the album jacket back and forth to each other to read and reread the liner notes and pass our thoughts back and forth about all the songs on the record. And so it's hard to say how Blood on the Tracks affected me at that point in my life. I feel now like I was probably behind somehow in really understanding what Dylan was laying down. I love the record, but I have to admit, at the time, as much as I got into it, as much as I listened to it every day for months, there was other music that was speaking to me more directly. As a side note to Blood on the Tracks for a minute, let's say the album came out in January 75, and I loved it and inhaled it. But as an example of how I personally processed or have been processing the album, if you take the song If You See Her, Say Hello, I can flat out say that the full impact of that song, or the fullest impact to date of that song, didn't hit me until the fall of last year, let's say 2021. Something kind of split open in the listening to it. And that's 45 years after hearing it for the first time, so sometimes it can take a while. The summer of 1975 was the first time in my life I was free to pretty much do whatever I wanted. I had a part-time job, but it wasn't much. Gas was about 60 cents a gallon, and I turned 18 that summer, so I spent a lot of hours just driving all over LA and try to soak up as much life as I could. That July, I saw Bob Marley at the Roxy, which was a nightclub that held about 350 people. To see Marley up close was one of the most profound music experiences I've ever had, and I'm glad I had the chance. I'm pretty sure it was that same summer that I heard word that Dylan was building a house in Malibu. I tried to check the date on the internet and found stuff that says he purchased that Malibu house in 1979, but I know he was living there well before that. Anyway, several times that summer, I drove out to Point Doom, which is a kind of promontory of land that sticks out from the Malibu coast, and I just drove around the narrow streets until I saw this giant wooden onion-shaped dome rising out of the top of a house that was under construction. And I pulled up across the street and sat there in my car with the radio on, watching construction workers come and go for an hour or so. There was like a chain link fence up, and it was mostly dirt and, yeah, just a construction site. The house was probably, I don't know, 80% done. I never saw Dylan or anyone that seemed to belong to the house other than workers. But I went out there a few times, and then I would just drive back home or wherever else I thought something interesting might be happening. That was quite a summer. The summer of 1975 was also the moment that I fell completely under the spell of Bruce Springsteen, who I'd been following for a couple years at that point. But when Born to Run came out that August, and I was able to see Springsteen perform that October again at the Roxy, it was really something. It was difficult for any other music or performer to come close to the transformative effect that Springsteen's music was having on me at that moment. Again, that's a subject for another story. There's a lot to that story, but in terms of Dylan, as Blood on the Tracks faded a little, that fall brought news of the Rolling Thunder extravaganza, which was tough for those of us on the West Coast because the tour never came out to California. That next fall, in 1976, I was back living in Los Angeles. And in late October or early November 1976, there was an announcement in the LA Times that the band was going to play their farewell concert at Winterland in San Francisco. And it was strongly hinted, rumored, that Dylan was going to play. So tickets went on sale, and they didn't sell out immediately because they were $25 each, which was a pretty steep sum in 1976. But the announcement said that the $25 included a full Thanksgiving dinner, so I went for it. I probably would have gone for it even without the dinner anyway. I drove north to San Francisco for Thanksgiving weekend, and on Thanksgiving morning, I headed over to Winterland around 9:30 or 10. I think the doors weren't scheduled to open until maybe 2 or 3 p.m., something like that. It was cold, clear, and very windy that morning, and there were only a few people around when I showed up, a dozen or so. After a while, a line started forming, and I remember Bill Graham was on the scene and saying hello to people in line and stuff, which was kind of his habit at big events. But the whole scene was pretty mellow and laid back and well organized. At a certain point, they started letting people into the hall, and they handed everyone a souvenir poster. And as you entered, you could see that the entire floor was laid out with banquet tables, covered with tablecloths and silverware. So the deal was you just found a seat anywhere and sat down, and then after a little while, servers started dishing out big plates of food, full-on Thanksgiving dinner, turkey and gravy, dressing, cranberries, green beans, all the other trimmings. And the spirit was just terrific. There was a small orchestra playing while people were eating, dressed in formal attire. It was very open, communal, kind of celebratory. So feeding everyone took a while, and then they cleared off the tables and folded them up and carted them away. And then everyone just found a seat or standing spot on the floor. And the concert began and unfolded. The poets read their poems, and then the band played their set, their first set. And then Dr. John and Ronnie Hawkins and Neil Diamond and Clapton and Butterfield and Muddy. And the concert began and unfolded, and the poets read their poems, and then the band played their first set, and then Dr. John and Ronnie Hawkins and Neil Diamond and Clapton and Butterfield and Muddy Waters and Joni and Neil Young and Van Morrison and all the rest did their thing. And then there was an intermission, and at a certain point I headed down from where I was sitting, and I worked my way through the crowd, and I got to within maybe 10 feet from the stage. And then the lights went down and Dylan came out in that red check shirt and big white hat, and they tore into Baby Let Me Follow You Down, which was both the opener and the closer of Dylan's set. And this was just the third time I'd seen Dylan, the earlier two times being during the 74 tour in Los Angeles, but this was the first time I was this close to Dylan while he was performing. Since the last waltz, I've been lucky enough to see Dylan perform dozens of times, often from within a very close distance, say 25 feet or less. And there's a big difference, more so than with most performers, between seeing Dylan that close or a little further back. His facial expressions are an ever-changing panoply of eyebrows rising and falling together and individually, eyeballs rolling to and fro, grimaces and half smiles, sometimes bursting into full-out laughter or accusing stares. He'll often pick out people in the first 10 rows or so and kind of make eye contact, usually a pretty girl. It's quite a show and somehow helps to anchor the music and Dylan's singing. It's an exponentially better experience to be close if you can swing it. The last Waltz concert was pretty much everything I could have hoped for and kind of a capstone to the past 3 years of Dylan's renewal, or whatever you might want to call it, starting with Pat Garrett and then Planet Waves and the 74 tour, Blood on the Tracks, Desire, and Rolling Thunder. Pretty wonderful stuff throughout. So Last Waltz is in November 1976, and then 1977 rolls around, and at least in Los Angeles, there was an explosion of new clubs and bands and energy in the rock and roll scene. Punk was happening full on, an early new wave. And that year I saw bands like Talking Heads, Blondie, Tom Petty, Mink DeVille, Patti Smith, The Clash, dozens of other great bands, all in clubs or very small venues. So that was where my musical head was at for the most part. It was an amazing period for live music on the West Coast and probably a lot of other places as well. As I've touched on before, Dylan's music was separate from that, and as much as I still listen to Dylan at home, the radio was playing all of this other fantastic new music, and it seemed that that was where music was headed, and that Dylan's music, while still great, represented a vestige from the past, and not something critical to the day-to-day at that time. It was kind of a separate love. And this continued through 1978, and then in May 1978, it was announced that Dylan would play a week's worth of shows at the Universal Amphitheater, which at the time was an open-air venue that held about 4,000 people, I think. And that was a time when you could still camp out for tickets, so I spent a long day and full night in the parking lot with a few hundred other hardy souls. And I remember it rained that night. Anyway, around 10 o'clock the next morning, tickets went on sale. I was able to get tickets for four shows of that week of shows. I think Dylan played six total or seven. And all the seats I got were in the first 10 rows, which was amazing. It was a strong dose of pretty intense Dylan watching that first week of June 1978. These shows later became known as the Vegas shows because Dylan had a trio of female backup singers on stage dressed in sparkly outfits. There was a saxophone in the band played by the great Steve Douglas. Dylan appeared with light-colored pancake makeup on his face and dark mascara around his eyes. Not exactly Las Vegas, but that's what some people thought. And the arrangements of the band were a little too flowery for me at the time, especially since I was immersed in a much more stripped-down, power-pop kind of sound, and it was a little hard for me to give myself over completely to what Dylan was doing at that moment. On the other hand, it was a transcendent experience to watch him from that close four nights in a row, more or less. And the band was amazing, and Dylan's singing was great. There was a couple new songs in the set, Senor, which I think was the second song he played every night. It was a fitting kickoff to that summer of 78 in Los Angeles. That same month of June 1978, Street Legal came out with the aforementioned Senor on it, and I played that record a lot all summer long, and as much as I loved it, it was still, as I've said more than a few times already, I was listening to it with a feeling in the background that Dylan was standing outside the mainstream of the music that I was really listening to hard at that time. I was too young for the late 60s LA scene with bands like The Doors and Arthur Lee's Love. But when 1979 came along, it was a phenomenally vibrant time in Los Angeles for music. lots of different clubs popping up everywhere, and new music every week just pouring out from everywhere. Music was everything to me at that moment, but Dylan wasn't that big a part of that conversation. And it was about that time that I started reading hints in the papers or magazines about Dylan having some kind of religious conversion. And then I remember hearing Gotta Serve Somebody on the radio from the upcoming Slow Train Coming album. And I remember digging the sound, but truthfully, I didn't have the intellectual or critical or spiritual wherewithal to dig what Dylan was doing in any intelligent kind of way. I got the record the day it came out. I remember I went to Tower Records and bought it, and I preferred the more secular songs on the album, but I wasn't really locked into what was going on. I did get a ticket for the shows, I think it was that fall, I guess, 1979 shows at the Santa Monica Civic. I went by myself. I couldn't get anyone to go with me. These were the sort of then infamous, now famous, gospel shows. And the concert was shocking. There's no other way for me to put it. The band sounded amazing, but the fire and brimstone of Dylan's performance, he was flat out preaching fundamentalist Bible text to the audience. It was just too much for me to wrap my mind around. I wasn't mad. I wasn't booing. I was more bemused. So I'll give myself credit for that at least, but probably more confused is the better word. But in any case, it was just another stone on the sometimes hard path of following Dylan. In the summer of 1981, a funny thing happened. I shook hands with Bob Dylan. I went to see Springsteen at the LA Sports Arena, a horrible clatterbox of a venue that no longer exists. But this was a week of shows that was kind of a coronation for Springsteen in Southern California. He'd always had a very strong fan base in LA, but this was like a homecoming. And the thing about concerts in LA back then was that there was always a moment when the celebrities latched on to a particular act, and that was Springsteen's year. So everybody who thought they were somebody just had to be there. And it was also kind of payback for the people who'd been behind the scenes for years because Springsteen played, I don't know, three or four nights. So there were plenty of comps to go around. By that point, I'd already seen Springsteen 10 times already. And I was friends with some people who got me backstage after the show. And I'm standing in this giant concrete locker room with a bunch of people trying to look cool, but having no idea what to do because the band hadn't come out yet. It was just this vast space. And I look over and I see Dylan standing by himself. And I was like, fuck it. So I walked over and like I said, there were very few people in there. And he sees me coming and he knew what was coming and he couldn't really escape because I was just barreling towards him. So I extended my hand. I said something like, I'm a big fan. And he did shake my hand, but it was absolutely the weakest, most disconnected handshake I've ever felt in my life. He had the attitude that I was like a piece of lint from the floor that had just kind of blown up in front of him. But still, I touched the man. Now, looking back, and as I've mentioned earlier in this podcast, I think that the music and the emotional power of Dylan's performances at that time, we're talking 1979 to 1983, were just outstanding, and it's a very compelling and powerful part of Dylan's history. But for me at the time, it probably served to push me away just a little bit. The album Saved, which I think is amazing today, was something I really couldn't process. Still, I was a loyal fan. I remember buying Shot of Love the day it came out and taking it home to my apartment and calling a friend on the phone to talk about it. But again, I was not worthy. Listening to Lenny Bruce for the first time, I burst out laughing at what seemed like a ridiculous song. And now I treasure every note and every version of that song. And then in 1984, here comes Infidels, and that was definitely a gateway back for many people, me included. License to Kill and especially Joker Man off that record really resonated for me. Looking back at Dylan's work today and seeing everything in context is a very different experience than participating in the moment when he's releasing material. 1985 saw Empire Burlesque, which is a funny record, but it came out at a time when I was on the road a lot, driving an old International Scout through the Western United States, and I put a pretty good tape deck into the Scout, and I hit the road just after Empire Burlesque came out. So I have vivid sense memories of popping in side A and then hearing that whoosh of backup singers at the top of Tight Connection to My Heart. And it's just a reminder that as much as we analyze our thoughts and feelings about a particular song, you need to allow space for the purely subjective, and that's the strongest connection you can have to a song. In 1986, I did see the Dylan Tom Petty tour a couple of times. I caught a show in Irvine, California, and I also drove south to San Diego to see another night on that tour. And I saw Dylan with the Grateful Dead in 1987. And those were fun shows, but they did feel somewhat bloated. And it was hard, again, to connect at the really deep level with what Dylan was putting out live. Those were also examples where I was not close. I remember the Petty shows. I was pretty far back in both arenas, and for the Grateful Dead, that was a show in a stadium, and I was way back. In 1988 and 89, which I guess is when the so-called never-ending tour started, Dylan started playing smaller venues in Los Angeles, and he played shows both of those years at the Greek Theater. And I went to both years, and both of those shows were in the late summer, late August or early September. They were a little sloppy, but Dylan did a solo set in the middle acoustically, and those were just knockouts, just really compelling. I guess the next big turning point for me in terms of my relationship to Dylan's music and how I thought about his work was when the first official bootleg series release, which was entitled Volumes 1 through 3, was released in 1991. And this was a big deal. And I think in many ways, it laid the groundwork for the ongoing reappreciation and renewed interest in Dylan that's been basically happening nonstop since then, which is now more than 30 years under the bridge. Incredible to think it's that long ago. So when Volumes 1 through 3 of the bootleg series came out, it was just after Oh Mercy and Under the Red Sky, and the release of those records had kind of stopped the creative skid, or that was a perception that Dylan seemed to have been on in the late 80s. But still, those two records did not inspire any real sense among most Dylan fans that he was about to launch into 30 more years of amazing music and performance. Instead, it felt like a small return to form at the tail end of his career. But the bootleg series seemed to hint at something else. It doesn't really track logically because the bootleg stuff was all from the past, and in truth, I'd heard a lot of the material already on scratchy vinyl and warbly cassette bootlegs, but hearing the package as a whole and hearing the songs that no one had heard before, like House Carpenter or Santa Fe, and especially Farewell Angelina, somehow gave an indication that Dylan, for all his genius and greatness, still had a lot more to show us. I played the shit out of that first bootleg series set. Starting in the late 80s, Dylan began touring with what we've come now to realize was a nearly superhuman intensity, and I was able to see Dylan live every year or two starting then. There were many amazing moments among those shows with a few standouts. In 1997, I was living and working in Vienna, Austria, and news came down the line that Dylan was ill with a pretty serious infection. I remember reading the small notice in the international papers about it, and it was not a good feeling. After a few weeks, more news came out that Dylan was on the road to recovery. Still, it seemed like he'd be out of commission for a while, at least. And then just a month or two later, a new Dylan album was released, Time Out of Mind. It was astonishing. In the 25 years since Time Out of Mind was released, Dylan has created so much amazing work that maybe the standing or reputation of Time Out of Mind has suffered a little. But the album was a righteous statement of artistic intent from Dylan. who was 56 years old at the time. I had a tiny little CD player with me in Vienna, and every night before I went to bed, I lay down and I played the album through. 11 songs, ending with the shaggiest of all dogs, the 16 and a half minute Highlands. And then, a few months later, Dylan announced some tour dates, including several at the El Rey Theater in Los Angeles, which is a terrific small place to see a show. And I flew back to Los Angeles in mid-December, and the next night saw Dylan at the El Rey with Willie Nelson sharing the bill. It was pretty emotional to see Dylan all hale and hearty and healthy, and he gave the audience a tremendously engaged set of songs, including several from Time Out of Mind. In 1999, I was lucky enough to see two more great Dylan shows, one at the opening of the Las Vegas House of Blues in March, and then that June, I saw Dylan share a bill with Paul Simon at the Hollywood Bowl. A friend gifted me great seats, which at the Bowl, which is a huge venue, is really something. And then just before the encores began, I noticed that Dylan gave a nod to the security guards down front. So I rushed down the aisle and got to the very front of the stage. I literally had my hands, I was front and center, had my hands on the Hollywood Bowl stage, seeing Dylan while leaning against the stage as he played to 20,000 people behind me with the amps blasting full. That was really something. The first 15 years of the new millennium saw Love and Theft, Modern Times, Together Through Life, and Tempest, along with the first Standards album, Shadows in the Night, and the holiday record, Christmas in the Heart. On top of that, there were 7 more very substantial releases of the bootleg series, and Dylan toured steadily with a constantly varied and shifting lineup of songs. And the great Dylan book, Chronicles, was published. A pretty amazing output for a man in his 70s. And then, in 2016, Dylan was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. And while that was just a symbolic gesture and really has no connection whatsoever to Dylan's creativity, it seemed to create or signal another shift. And that shift has to do with Dylan's audience, which is no longer composed of the people who got turned on to him in the 60s, plus a few latecomers like me who only started listening in the 70s. Dylan's audience today is truly astonishing. I have no idea how numerous or broad it really is, but it's vast and varied. In the spring of 2017, a friend of mine asked me if, since I seemed to care so much about Dylan's music, whether I'd be interested in giving some kind of presentation to a writing group that I sometimes participated in. And I was flattered, but I declined because I told him I had no idea what I would say or how to present my thoughts about Dylan in any kind of organized fashion. But then, just a few months after that, I woke up having the idea for this podcast, which sort of came to me as I was sleeping, pretty much complete in my head. Of course, it's changed since that first moment, but the basic outline did come to me in the flash of a dream. And as I started working on the idea, there was an announcement about the creation of the Bob Dylan Archives in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with an inaugural event that fall of 2017. And I've been to Tulsa twice now and planning another trip to coincide with the official opening of the Bob Dylan Center in May of 2022. And hopefully this episode will be out then. And the Bob Dylan Center will be kind of the public face of the research and archival institution that they're building down there. So this activity has coincided with me putting a public face on my Dylan life in the form of this podcast, and that's also meant new interactions with all sorts of Dylan researchers and scholars and fans through the Tulsa connection and also through the sometimes annoying, oftentimes hilarious, but usually really interesting world of the Dylan superbrain on social media. So this podcast first appeared in January of 2019, and there were some things going on in my life that sort of transformed the making of the podcast into a kind of life anchor. And I can easily and honestly say that working on the series has been the most rewarding creative work that I've undertaken in the past few years. And then, in the fall of 2019, Dylan announced a new tour of the United States, starting on the West Coast that October and ending with a run of shows at the Beacon Theater in New York. I was amazed and surprised and excited, and I got tickets to the very second show of the tour, which was at the Santa Barbara Bowl, under a full harvest moon. And then I started thinking, maybe this would be the last Dylan tour. He was almost 80 at that point, and who knew what was coming down the line. So I splurged and flew to New York City in early December for what I thought would be the last show of the tour. But that old sly fox Dylan went and added one more show in Washington, D.C. So I ended up seeing the second and the second to last shows of that tour. And they were both wonderful. Talked about them in some detail in the last episode. The past few years have been an amazing time to be a Dylan fan for a number of reasons. Social media has helped to expand the Dylan fan base and scholarship, so there's a lot of new energy being shared around listening to and appreciating Dylan, and that's had a kind of snowball effect, I think. The bootleg series has continued to deliver some incredible music, and even though I talked about this in the last episode, I don't think the magnitude of Dylan's last record, Rough and Rowdy Ways, can be overstated. That moment in March of 2020, just after a worldwide lockdown for the COVID pandemic was announced, standing at my desk when Murder Most Foul suddenly appeared on the internet, was definitely one of the most powerful non-concert musical experiences I've ever had. And now Dylan is touring again. He played a few nights ago in New Orleans. He played Charlotte, North Carolina last night. And he's playing almost all of the new record live, and there are still people saying it's the best show they've ever seen, and there are still people saying it's a waste of time, and all the songs sound the same, and they can't understand a word Dylan is singing. In a 60-year span of surprising moments, Murder Most Foul and the Rough and Rowdy Ways album and this current tour might be Dylan's most amazing or surprising moments. But this idea of ranking songs in concerts and periods is ultimately a waste of energy. To say Dylan's late output is equal to his mid-60s work, what does that mean? Equal in what way? There's maybe a pretty complex notion hear about subjective versus objective reality, but I keep returning to this idea of Dylan and experience itself, for that matter, as a road, a path, and we just have to keep trying to move further along. I never take any moment of experiencing Dylan's work for granted. I pay as much attention as I can, and I hope I keep learning from what he's doing. Beyond that, I just try to revel as much as I'm able, and the pleasure that comes from listening to the music. If you're still listening to this episode, my hat's off to you. It would be if I was wearing a hat. But really, I feel like this has been a pretty self-indulgent exercise, and I'm questioning the value of it for anyone but myself. Hopefully, it's been at least a little entertaining and illuminating. As I've alluded to elsewhere in these broadcasts, the making of this series has been a source of enormous energy and reflection for me, and I'm grateful to whatever audience there is for helping to facilitate that. The email is info@abobdylanprimer.com, and the website is www.abobdylanprimer.com. If you visited the website before, over the past couple of years, a number of the links that I posted stopped working. I've replaced all of those bad links with new ones, and there's some pretty amazing stuff to check out. Several for each episode listed on the individual episode pages. If you enjoy this series, please shout out to whoever and however you do. We've also got Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter accounts, if that's how you roll. My name is Michael Hacker. Thank you for listening.